Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama succeeded where Columbus, for all his importance, failed. Da Gama found the fabled Indies and opened the gates to European trade with the East. He rounded Africa, landed on the shores of India. Not only that, says my guest today, Vasco da Gama brought Europe face to face again with Islam when Europe was the poor cousin and turned, he says, the tide. This hour on Point, the amazing voyages of Vasco da Gama and their long echoes through history. You can join the conversation. Do you remember Vasco da Gama from middle school history class? Do you really know what was happening in those voyages, those years? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is historian and journalist Nigel Cliff. His new book is Holy War: How Vasco da Gama's Epic Voyages Turned the Tide in a Centuries-Old Clash of Civilizations. The Kansas City Star calls it one of the most readable, engaging, provoking books of the season, hands down. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nigel Cliff, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
You paint a picture right off the bat in this book of how you imagine from sources and what comes down to us that epical moment when, I guess, the first European ship hits the shore of India. Give us the year and give us the scene.
It's 1497 when Vasco da Gama sets sail, 1498 when he arrives in India. But this voyage has been almost a century in the planning, since the 1420s when the Portuguese first thought of sailing down the west coast of Africa and then through the Atlantic, reaching the Cape of Good Hope, and then Vasco da Gama sailing into the Indian Ocean all the way up the east coast of Africa and crossing for the first time to India. It was an epic voyage of 2 years, but it was the culmination of many, many generations and decades of work.
How do you picture that landing? You described it in the book, but share some of that with us. Paint a picture of what that might have been like.
The pilot who guided Vasco da Gama and his three ships across the ocean sailed them into a thunderstorm, and they couldn't see the coast for a while. It was a very dramatic arrival with great peals of thunder and lightning. When the storm cleared, they actually found themselves surrounded by fishermen who had come to offer their wares. And in return for buying most of the goods on offer, they found out they were in the wrong place. This paradise beach they were opposite was not the famed city of Calicut, which they had been heading for so many years. So they lifted anchor and they sailed down the coast to this great sprawling city, which was the center of the international spice trade. And
this is on the southwest coast of India, today Kerala.
Yes. Then known more as the Malabar Coast. The monsoon-swept area of southwest India, which is fertile ground for growing spices. At this point, nobody knew what to expect. There had been very little contact with India for centuries. And rather than Vasco da Gama himself or one of his commanders going onshore, they sent a convicted criminal who was one of the people who'd been brought along to do the dirty work. This convict was taken by the fishermen to the house of a Muslim from Tunis, a merchant from the Mediterranean who came from the place furthest to the west that they'd ever heard of. And this man happened to speak Spanish. So these two had a conversation there on the coast of India in Spanish. The Tunisian merchant saying, "What the devil are you doing here?" And the convict, rather grandly, pulling himself up and saying, "We have come in search of Christians and spices."
What did they find?
They found spices. At least they found one of the points of the great spice trade triangle around the Indian Ocean. They didn't find many Christians. They found a large number of Muslim merchants who'd been settled there for many centuries, had intermarried, had large, rich communities. But they did find, when they were first taken in, ceremonially into the town with great crowds cheering and lining the rooftops, they did find themselves being taken to what they thought was a great church. It was a strange-looking church. It had a column with a metal rooster outside and some tinkling bells, and it was rather heavy with smoke inside. There was a little temple in the middle, and the Portuguese thought that they heard that this was a shrine to the Virgin Mary. So they knelt on the floor in adoration of the Virgin and felt that they were among friends.
You described them kind of gabbling along with the local language they didn't understand, hearing something that sounded like Christ to them, but Krishna. And
Krishna,
what in fact was going on there?
They had arrived in one of the main Hindu parts of India. At this point, there was a substantial and powerful empire called the Vijayanagara Empire, which stretched across most of southern India. And all of these rich and ancient monasteries and temples they found were, of course, Hindu. And the what they thought were saints on the wall, rather strange saints with their teeth poking out several inches and rather sort of diabolical features, turned out to be Hindu deities. But at this point, they had absolutely no idea that there was a religion called Hinduism, and they knew that Muslims refused to worship images. Mm-hmm. So they assumed that since they couldn't be Muslims, they must be Christians.
Now, they had heard for eons of Prester John, a Christian monarch in this part of the realm. They were looking for Christians there. They didn't find Prester John. Remind us who he was supposed to be, but they did find some Christians. And tell us about that.
Prester John was a figure whose fame reached back, I think, to the 12th century. He had been associated with various powerful groups, the Mongols and other invaders, in the hopes that a Christian ally would come riding out of the east and defeat the Muslims, push them back out of Europe. Eventually, it was discovered that he was the emperor of Ethiopia. And Ethiopia was thus thought to be an enormous and powerful country, a great Christian empire where the Prester had perhaps a million soldiers at his command, all wielding gold swords. The Prester himself dining in a hall on an emerald table with 32 bishops and 8 kings to his side. He was thought to be the answer to Europe's dreams, a man who was so powerful that he could tip the balance of power in the world towards the Christian West.
The reality of the Christian presence in Kerala on the coast of India was somewhat more modest.
It was indeed, one of the reasons being that for a long time, East Africa and India had been sort of muddled together. They were thought to be somehow connected. And so even though the Prester was supposed to now be in Ethiopia, his presence was expected to be strongly felt in India. In fact, the Portuguese found at most, and this was on Vasco da Gama's second voyage, about 20,000 Indians, St. Thomas Indians, living on the southern tip of the subcontinent.
Christians who as a result of the travels there, again, centuries before, by Thomas, had taken up the Christian faith. Pull back the lens for us a little bit here to this time and how this voyage fell into this time, the end of the 15th century. Why was Vasco da Gama's voyage important?
This was a time when the push and pull of between Islam and Christianity once again seemed to be going very much in the Muslims' favor. The great city of Constantinople, which really was the to all intents the capital of Christendom for many centuries, fell to the Turks in the 1450s, just 40 some years before this voyage. The Turks were invading Eastern Europe. They were marching towards Africa. Towards Vienna, and also towards Rome. And the emperor, the new Turkish emperor, saw himself as the new Caesar, the rightful heir to the great Roman Empire. So this was a time of great fear and consternation for the Christian West. The year 1500 was seen as a watershed by many people. And I think it's no coincidence that in the 1490s, the last emirate, Muslim emirate, was expunged from Spain. Columbus sailed west to try and find the Indies, and Vasco da Gama sailed east to find the Indies. This was seen as a time when the biblical prophecies of the end times were drawing near, and one way or another, it was a point at which one religion or the other was going to seize the future of the world.
And as you say, really, the start of the West's dominance in trade, maybe the start of its, well, certainly the start of its imperial mission there with Vasco da Gama. Nigel Clifford, it's so great to have you with us. There's much more we want to learn. The new book is Holy War, How Vasco da Gama's Epic Voyages Turned the Tide in a Centuries-Old Clash of Civilizations. You can read an excerpt at our website, and you can join us. Do you remember from sixth grade class Columbus, Magellan, and Vasco da Gama how he sailed around the tip of Africa and into the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean? Did you really understand what he was up to? Famed in Portuguese history and beyond, Giacomo Meyerbeer's opera L'Africaine was first performed in 1865. Tells a fictional version of events in the life of Vasco da Gama. Here's Luciano Pavarotti singing Da Gama's big aria from the opera O Paradiso. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the amazing voyages of explorer Vasco da Gama, the man who found the Indies, at least from the European perspective, when Columbus did not, and brought Europe face to face again with Islam. Nigel Cliff is with us today from London, historian, author, critic, author of the new book Holy War, How Vasco da Gama's Epic Voyages Turned the Tide in a Centuries-Old Clash of Civilizations. That story famed always in Portugal. Portugal's great national epic is Os Lusíadas, written 1572 by Luís Vaz de Camões, tells the story of Portugal's 15th and 16th century voyages of discovery, including those of Vasco da Gama. Here are the opening stanzas from an audiobook version.
As armas e os barões assinalados que da ocidental praia lusitana por mares nunca de antes navegados passaram ainda além da Taprobana.
To give you a sense of how it is in the Portuguese epic, arms and the heroes who from Lisbon's shore through seas where sail was never spread before, beyond where Ceylon lifts her spicy breast and waves her woods above the watery waste, with prowess more than human forced their way to the fair kingdoms of the rising day. And there, from Os Lusíadas, the great Portuguese national epic. Nigel Cliff, in London, you remind us that at this time, for Christians, the East, capital E, was the wellspring of the world, the Bible was its history book, Jerusalem was its capital of faith, somewhere suspended between heaven and earth, and the Garden of Eden was firmly believed to be flowering somewhere in Asia. Those are pretty high expectations. What was Vasco da Gama's goal?
It was nothing less than to reach Jerusalem and take it back for Christendom. That was a long way off. There were a number of steps to get through first. And on his first voyage, Vasco da Gama was commissioned by his king to reach India, to make an alliance with its leaders, to oust the Muslims from the spice trade, to take the wealth of the spice trade for Europe, and with that new wealth, and hopefully, as we were saying before, the vast troops of Prester John, the Eastern Christian king they were looking for, to sail up the Red Sea, cross through what's now Israel, and conquer Jerusalem.
Of course, he came upon this scene finally, coming around, famously, around the Cape of Good Hope and across the Indian Ocean. There he found Christians who had been there for a long time before him, but no Prester John with his big armies. but coming into a very established Islamic world that made the Europeans look like pretty small potatoes, as you describe it at that time, Nigel.
Pretty small. Vasco da Gama brought some paltry little trade goods with him that were maybe useful in Africa, but had absolutely no purpose in India. This was a civilization of some millennia, which had absorbed the Greek culture, the Persian culture, the Islamic culture, and many others. The rituals that the king went through each day just to get up and bathe lasted several hours. And when he went out, he was followed by a retinue of some thousands of retainers. So they really stumbled onto India not knowing what on earth to expect, and made themselves look somewhat foolish. One of the Indian king, he was called the Zamorin, one of the Zamorin's men, said, "These are goods that are not even worthy of a lowly grocer, never mind the representative of what you say is one of the great kings in the world."
They were in an Indian Hindu environment there, but it was part of a great Muslim zone of trade where Arabic was the lingua franca. What about the Islamic world at this time? And it would have been 700 years or so before the time that Muslim conquerors had marched deep into Europe. What did the Islamic world look like as he sailed?
The Islamic world had split up many years ago into rival sects and rival areas of influence. That at this time, the Egyptians were still powerful. They had ruled most of Palestine, Syria, and as well as Egypt and North Africa for centuries. But increasingly, the Turks, the Ottomans in Constantinople, now Istanbul, were the great threat. They had not had any incursions into India themselves, but over the centuries, large numbers of Muslim warriors had reached India, and most of the north of India was Muslim territory. This empire clung on in the south, a Hindu empire. But even there, around the coasts, Muslim traders really ran the cities and controlled the wealth. And at a time when goods moved much more easily across the water than across land, really the perimeter of the oceans were the wealthiest and busiest parts of the countries, and these were in Muslim hands.
You describe how in their desire to find and cultivate and trade with and maybe dominate this part of the world, Europe had sent out spies, very important, Portugal itself, but spies of a different sort who would have to go out for many years and travel all over the place and come back with maps secreted in their bags and clothing to give some sense of what was out there. They had little idea.
This is one of my favorite stories in the book. There had been little information about India or indeed most of Asia since the days of Marco Polo, who had been allowed in when the Mongols were in power. Since then, the Islamic empires had shut off access to the East for Christian Europe. Hence, the only way to get there was to sail all the way around Africa with a view to essentially reaching Jerusalem near the eastern shore of the Mediterranean.
We talk about the Age of Discovery, or used to, I mean, in the school books, as this sort of glorified quest to push the boundaries of human knowledge. But Vasco da Gama was hardly just a sweet scholar on those seas. He was a pretty tough guy.
He was. He was a stalwart man, a sort of man of heavy build, of a ruddy complexion, and a man who could control his rather haphazardly selected groups of sailors. Some, as I said before, convicts. A lot just hardened adventurers who would go anywhere for a fight. He had to be a commander. At the same time, he had to also be an ambassador, a diplomat. He had to negotiate with kings. And if necessary, and it did prove necessary, he had to be a war leader as well.
Of course, what's necessary can be open to a lot of interpretation. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Nigel Cliff is with us. His new book is Holy War, describes the voyages of Vasco da Gama. Warner in Waynesboro, Virginia. Warner, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I just wanted to read, if I may, a little brief snippet from Bill Bryson's most recent book, At Home, where he talks about da Gama and his travels.
Yes.
He says, "Vasco da Gama was a breathtakingly vicious man. On one occasion, He captured a Muslim ship carrying hundreds of men, women, and children, locked the passengers and crew in the hold, carried off everything of value, and then gratuitously, appallingly, set the ship ablaze. Almost everywhere he went, Gama abused or slaughtered people he encountered, and so set a tone of distrust and brutish violence that would characterize and diminish the whole of the age of discovery. I thought your guest could perhaps comment on that.
Yeah, he not only, I'm sure he can, he describes it in quite gruesome detail. And there it is, Nigel Cliff. Warner raises it. You describe it as well. What was going on? And was that this typical of Vasco da Gama?
Certainly in my book, I'm not making any apologies for the man whatsoever. I think the understanding one has to bring to this subject is what a ruthless age he lived in, and to what extent it was felt to be acceptable and even desirable to fight in a merciless way for one's religion.
But these were Muslim pilgrims, including women and children, on their way to Mecca.
Absolutely. It is a shocking episode, and I found it grueling to write about.
Give us your version of what happened.
Well, Vasco da Gama had been sent out with instructions from his king to stop shipping from sailing from India to Arabia. And it was pretty clear what those instructions meant. It meant making a ruthless show of force in order to put pilgrims and merchants off from making the journey. So he lay in wait with his convoy of, I think, about 19 ships at this point for the big dhows to sail back from Arabia laden with their riches. The Miri, the ship he eventually hit upon, was one of the richest of all. It belonged to the emissary of Mecca to India. The owner of the ship was actually on board the emissary, and he tried to negotiate with Vasco da Gama, offering him increasingly enormous amounts of loot in return for leaving him and his wives and children and his fellow pilgrims' wives and children alone. But Vasco da Gama had his orders, and he sent his men to board and set fire to the ship. The soldiers who set fire to it then had a hard time of it, because when they sailed away, they found they hadn't taken all of the arms and stones and other weapons off the ship, and they found themselves under attack. So another ship sailed over to try to finish off the job and got boarded by the people on the Miri, and this dreadful grappling at sea went on with everyone trying to sink each other's ships for days on end.
I seem to remember you describing Vasco da Gama looking down through the portal into this hold full of women and children, but not walking away from burning the ships.
That's right, and the one of the versions of this event that has come down to us was written by a scribe on one of the ships, and he was as appalled and horrified as we would be by this. There's no excuse for it. The only thing to do is to compare it to similar events where entire cities, which were captured by a rival army, whether a religious army, you know, whether the army was on a holy war or a normal campaign, it was normal practice for the entire city to be torched and all of the residents to be either put to death or taken away as slaves. It was an extraordinarily brutal time.
There's been this debate over whether Vasco da Gama is best thought of first as explorer or pirate. You convey some of that debate.
Yes. I think that there's a huge element of piracy in what the Portuguese activities ended up as. They had fine intentions in many ways, but out in the east, thousands of miles from home, people behaved as they do, and there was a lot of looting that went on. There was a lot of pillage, and a lot of the time the ideals behind the voyage were pretty much forgotten.
And yet, even in that bloody scene, the boundaries of understanding were pushed out. Jack's calling from Ontario, Canada. Jack, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Hi.
Yeah, we just returned from our second trip to Portugal. We were over there in February and early March and spent quite a bit of time in and around Lisbon, especially the area called Valem, which is very interesting. It has the large monastery of St. Jeromos, which you've got to see to believe. It just covers acres. And this is where the Vasco da Gama and all the gentlemen prayed before they went off into the unknown. Mm-hmm. And down right on the waterfront is a very large statue called the Voyage of Discoveries. It both sides, it's shaped like a caravel ship, and it has everybody on it that was of importance. Even the queen is carved in the works on both sides of the this area. And the gardens and the tower of Belém, right on the front of the waterfront, it's an absolutely stunning area.
Jack, how did it leave you? What did it leave you thinking about these men and their voyages?
Well, the booty, if you want to call it, that they brought back from what they called the New World, made Portugal absolutely filthy rich, and this is what they were doing. They were made the king wealthy beyond compare, and then they dressed up this St. Jeronimo's cathedral or monastery with just tons of gold leaf, and it was very interesting. It's interesting, really.
Yeah, absolutely, the wealth that came back there. I wondered, Nigel, there's Portugal's monument and cathedral where they took off, and monument in memory. What about was there an active competition between Spain and Portugal, Columbus and da Gama? Was it personal? They were making their repeat voyages in the same period of years.
Absolutely. I mean, you were saying before that we distantly remember Vasco da Gama's name from school. Of course, in Portugal, his name's everywhere on football mm-hmm. teams and stadia and shopping centers, wherever you go. And the building that Jack was referring to there was initially when the sailors departed on the first voyage, it was a little chapel, a little whitewashed stone chapel. By the time Vasco da Gama had set off on his second voyage, this gigantic monastery was rising in its place with the wealth brought back from India. So one of the sources of the competition between Spain and Portugal was of course to get this wealth for one country or the other, and the Portuguese had a long head start. They'd been planning these missions since the 1420s. Spain came to it very late in the 1480s, and took a chance on a guy who was seen as a bit of a maverick, Columbus, who had in fact lived in Portugal for a number of years at this point and had learnt all about the Portuguese explorations, but was not treated with any seriousness when he suggested sailing what essentially seemed like the wrong way to get to India. So he took himself off to Spain instead, and we know the results. Yeah. The peculiar thing about Columbus's subsequent fame is, of course, that he failed to do what he set out to do, which was to reach India.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the voyages, the amazing voyages of explorer Vasco da Gama, the man who found the Indies for the Europeans when Columbus did not, brought Europe face to face again with Islam, and much more. My guest is Nigel Cliff, author of the big new book, Holy War, How Vasco da Gama's Epic Voyages Turned the Tide in a Centuries-Old Clash of Civilizations. Nigel, what about that turning of the tide? I mean, here at the beginning of these voyages, they've never been around in any serious way the Cape of Good Hope. You know, by the end of his life, he's blasting away with cannon in the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, and a new era has begun. How do you describe the turning of the tide here? What happened?
I think it was a very deliberate attempt to reverse 700 years of history. In the early years of the Islamic arrival in Europe, Spain had become Spain was the term that was also used for Portugal at that point, had become an extremely powerful and sophisticated Islamic nation. The Crusaders who went east had marched on Jerusalem, but equally there was another crusade going on at what was then the western fringe of the world for Spain. And after several hundred years, Spain was, as the Christians would say, purified. The Crusaders in Spain then looked outward, and naturally their gaze turned to Africa, and then around Africa to India, and then finally, when they reached India, far into the east, to Indonesia, to China. And this really was a point, I think, at which the balance of power did tip. The Europeans, first of all, discovered that they could get out of the straitjacket they'd been put in and commandeer the world by taking to the sea. And second, after that, that they had the resources that they needed to become the predominant power against the Muslim world.
You're right. Nearly 1,400 years ago, two great religions crashed into each other and competed for the wealth and soul of the world. Why did, if his gifts that he brought with him to give to the local notables when he arrived were so sort of kind of meager in their eyes, if the Europe was so much less advanced in trade in this region, if his boats and everything about these Europeans looked kind of lame when they first ended up on these shores, why were they able to turn the tide?
I mean, it's a mystery why after sailing 12,000 miles, you would hand over a few beads, maybe a couple of hats, a metal basin, and some, almost some sort of soap and perfume. That I can't explain, except that in some ways they thought that the East was a magical place where they could just help themselves to all the goods that were on offer for free, and no one would really stop them. They turned the tide because they eventually took control of the maritime trade of Asia, which included the spice trade, which to some extent is comparable to the oil trade.
Did they do that because they were more willing to bring force of arms to bear, because they were more capable with arms, or why? I mean, there was such a long and established Islamic civilization here. Why did it give way?
They were much more willing to use arms, and they were better at them. They had better cannon. They had better ships. And the Indian Ocean had before been rather a peaceful place. There were a few shots fired from merchant ships before they arrived in anger. And there were many after the Portuguese came. I wouldn't, of course, say that Vasco da Gama's voyages were the whole story, but I think this episode opened the way for then the Dutch and the English to create the East India Companies, which then continued to commandeer trade in the East, and the wider story of the Portuguese attempts to reach Asia were, of course, what drove Columbus to America as well.
For centuries, Nigel Cliff writes, Islam had all but blocked Europe's access to the East, and then comes da Gama, and around the Cape of Good Hope. Anne in Sharon, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Anne.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been recently reading a book called 1421, and it is about the Chinese in 1421 having a huge group of ships that were able to go on the ocean on voyages for 2 years and provide unbelievably good, healthy food at the time, and the ships were way, way sophisticated, according to this book. I was wondering if there was a fellow that was on one of those ships who was Portuguese and married a Muslim and then went back to Portugal and gave a chart, a map, to the Queen. And supposedly, in the book, this chart was used by the Portuguese explorers. I was wondering.
It's wild and wonderful. Let us pick it up. Nigel, what about this great Chinese fleet? We've heard of that. And about was there interplay between the Portuguese and Chinese? And
I think the person in question is a guy called Niccolò di Conti, who is actually Italian, although he certainly did have some contact with the Portuguese, and he was responsible for in many ways for the theory that you could sail around Africa to get to the East, because that was something that was still much debated at the time. He came back and gave some information to a guy called Fra Mauro, a monk who made maps on the island of Murano near Venice. And Fra Mauro put some very excited captions on his map, showing that it was that some Chinese junks had, in fact, rounded Africa. It seems that certainly from my research that the this information was got somewhat muddled along the way, and that probably what he was referring to was in fact some either Arab or Indian ships crossing the Indian Ocean to Africa, rather than actually rounding the Cape of Good Hope. But absolutely, there were huge Chinese fleets. They were called treasure fleets, which sailed into the Indian Ocean in the early 15th century. In a peculiar inversion of what the Portuguese were doing, they brought gifts rather than wanting to take treasure away. They dispensed their largesse around the shores of the ocean just to show, you know, how powerful and rich they were. And shock people into becoming their vassals, and it's another instance of many in which the Portuguese were extremely fortunate in their timing, because had these great junks been on the sea at the time when Vasco da Gama arrived, his little ships would have looked extremely puny in comparison, and probably wouldn't have been paid much attention. But the Chinese, for their own internal reasons, ceased to trade by sea a few decades before Vasco da Gama arrived, and hence they pretty much had the ocean to themselves.
Seems like this amazing century of so much fluidity. Here you've got a great Chinese fleet in these seas, all the Arabic spoken in the Islamic world there, and then here comes Europe kind of up for grabs. But in the event, this is the century that begins the great age of Europe's expansion, the imperial era and colonialism, all the rest, world history being written here. Chris in Amherst, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was interested in kind of the more the detail of the spices that came back from India, and if he could contrast it with what came back from Columbus's voyages, and what they actually traded with, what the economics of it.
The spices that were valued more than gold and silver and all the rest, what exactly were they bringing back? Why was it so valuable? And how did it compare to what Columbus brought home, Nigel?
Well, some of the spices we wouldn't have heard of anymore. Zedoary, if that's how you pronounce it, is one that's not much used.
No, I don't put that on my eggs.
And some of the things that were called spices, we wouldn't call spices at all. There was something called ambergris, which is basically a secretion of the intestines of the sperm whale, which was coughed up and hardened in the sea and washed up on the beaches, a very valued commodity at the time in medicines. The spice trade was enormously valuable.
Also, I don't know, cinnamon and pepper and cardamom?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Every kitchen in the West worth name had sacks of nutmeg and cinnamon, which they just unloaded into dishes with abandon. I mean, they liked their food heavy and spicy in flavors. Columbus brought back very little in the way of spices. I mean, of course, you know, he landed in Cuba and the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
He brought back some branches which he thought smelt a bit like cinnamon, and something that looked like gold but turned out to be iron pyrite, fool's gold. On his second voyage, he knew that he had to bring up the goods, so his crew went round sort of scratching and sniffing every tree you can imagine, and they sort of they convinced themselves that they were in the Spice Islands. In fact, they thought they'd reached Japan, and then when they reached the mainland of America, they thought they were in China. Columbus, during his lifetime, went out of favor as Vasco da Gama's success became evident. He was on his third voyage. He was cast in chains and brought back a prisoner to Spain.
Was the southwest coast of India collecting spices from across Southeast Asia at this point? I mean, ultimately, the Spice Island sense of those moved much further east to Indonesia and that whole area. Were they trading already and collecting these things in Calicut and beyond so that the Portuguese would find them there in India, or were they locally grown?
they were trading. They had been for centuries. The Romans had sent great big ships from Egypt after they'd ousted Cleopatra from her throne. They had a regular convoy going across to India to buy spices. So this was an extremely ancient trade, I think certainly dating back 3 millennia. And there were three points of a triangle which were the main trading cities in the Indian Ocean: a city called Hormuz, a city called Aden, and Calicut. And Calicut was really the place where the spices were gathered after they'd arrived from Sri Lanka, from Indonesia, and the Spice Islands themselves. There were also large crops grown on the Malabar coast, in Kerala, mainly pepper, plantations which just stretched for miles and miles down the coast. Mm. So this was a lucrative and bustling trade that had been known since ancient times.
Dave in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air with Nigel Cliff. Dave.
Hi, Tom. I'm a sailor. And I wanted to point out that what really allowed the Europeans to prevail when they came up against these civilizations was they had technology that nobody else had. They were able to trade by sea. Columbus did not discover the New World. What he discovered was trade winds. Vasco da Gama had a spanker sail. That allowed him, for the first time, to be able to sail around the Horn of Africa. Previous sail technology did not allow that. And they recognized that by sea, and as today, you can ship hundreds of times more goods for a fraction of the price. So as soon as they established sea routes, the Silk Road was obvious. It was no longer valuable. And they mastered and kept that ability to navigate by sea. The Chinese couldn't do it. They could go one way at one season, another way another season. Columbus could sail around the New World back again anytime he wanted. Vasco da Gama could get around the Horn. None of the other nations, none of the other civilizations had that technology, and they didn't realize what a great advantage it would give them.
Dave, I really appreciate your call. And no doubt they brought different systems with them. They had a lot to learn about those trade winds and monsoon winds. Da Gama paid a heavy price for sailing against those winds on his way home, as I recall you writing, Nigel, on his first voyage. But do you see that, the sailing technology, as the key factor?
It's certainly one of the key factors. I think you have to look at why the voyages were undertaken in the first place. Who in their right mind would go sailing halfway around the world for what, some spices and a little bit of wealth? I mean, it's a journey that even with the technology, was very likely to end in death, and did end in death for the majority of the sailors. But absolutely, the ships, the sails were a mixture of square sails and lateen sails, triangular sails, they weren't necessarily new developments in themselves. The ships were much more strongly built than any ships the Arabs and Indians had. The ships of the Indian Ocean, in fact, were sewn together with coconut fibre, and were pretty leaky and really would not have been capable of withstanding the great storms that these Portuguese crews faced up to on the trip round the Cape of Good Hope.
You bring it down to holy war, right, in the title of your book, for the inspiration here and the fact of what unfolded in these journeys. I mean, what do we learn from this encounter between religious cultures in those years? Does it have pertinence today? Is it just a fascinating page in the history books?
I think it's a great story in itself, and there are lessons to draw from the story about human behavior, about the way that, for instance, an explorer acts outside of his own society. It tells you a lot about what that society was like at the time. But I think it does have a wider significance. I think if we look at what was driving the Spanish and the Portuguese, why the Spanish and the Portuguese were the great explorers, it was because their countries had been the place of a very powerful Muslim country. They had taken up the mantle and the sword of the Crusaders to drive them out, and that was the attitude with which they sailed halfway around the world. So I think that there's a pattern you can detect here, a sort of push and pull between East and West, between Islam and Christianity. And I think to say that the Age of Discovery was carried out in a sort of disinterested spirit of exploration is to miss this fundamental driving force of faith that impelled people halfway around the world. And this turning point, it was the beginning of, as far as I believe, of the Western ascendancy of what we call the modern world, the modern age, when the Christian West became more powerful than the Muslim East. There are those who would who see this as a watershed on the Islamic side too, and who would wish to turn back that tide. So I think the more we understand that this was a push and pull that had involved both sides, that the blame and the responsibility are shared on both sides, that the pattern is larger than just one period of history might suggest, the more we can understand each other's attitudes and beliefs.
Little sailing ships and the great push and pull of history and civilizations there. Nigel Cliff's new book is Holy War: How Vasco da Gama's Epic Voyages Turned the Tide in a Centuries-Old Clash of Civilizations. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nigel Cliff, we're very grateful to you for joining us today from London. Thank you so much. Terrific book.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Nigel Cliff. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And when you go to Facebook, hit that like button, become a fan. You'll get the early word on upcoming shows. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.